This is The Guardian.
Looking for your next great podcast? We live in unprecedented times. To make sense of it, what if you could learn from some of the most influential people on the planet? The podcast Tools and Weapons is hosted by Microsoft's Vice Chair and President Brad Smith. Every week, he has a candid conversation with guests, including prime ministers and Pulitzer Prize-winning journalists. The latest episode features Bayer CEO Bill Anderson. Though most of us know Bayer for pharmaceuticals, they're also focused on crop science. They're putting digital tools in the hands of farmers to get the most out of every acre. Listen to Tools and Weapons with Brad Smith, wherever you get your podcasts.
Science Weekly is supported by Rainforest Trust. In honor of this year's Earth Day, we're promoting Rainforest Trust's Brazilian Amazon Fund throughout April. Rainforest Trust is a 501c3 organization, which means that 100% of all money donated goes directly to conservation efforts. The fund has already helped protect more than 6.5 million acres of rainforest habitat. But Rainforest Trust still needs to protect a further 13 million acres to reach its goal. You can help. Donate online at rainforesttrust.org/Earth Day this April, and your generous gift will be quadruple matched for the Brazilian Amazon.
After decades of delays and billions of dollars over budget, the James Webb Space Telescope finally launched in 2021.
Decollage, liftoff from a tropical rainforest to the edge of time itself, James Webb begins a voyage back to the birth of the universe.
And since becoming operational late last year, it's been dazzling us with stunning images.
Finally tonight, NASA is celebrating the first full year of the James Webb Space Telescope with a breathtaking new image of stars at the moment of their birth.
But the James Webb Space Telescope hasn't just been taking awe-inspiring photographs. It's been making discoveries that are baffling scientists.
One of the scientists I spoke to said it's bananas, like it was completely sort of different from what they'd expected.
So what have we learned from James Webb this year? And how is it transforming our understanding of the universe? From The Guardian, I'm Madeleine Finlay, and this is Science Weekly. Hannah Devlin, science correspondent for The Guardian. The James Webb Space Telescope has been in space for almost 2 years now, and I really can't believe how quickly that's gone. So perhaps you can help us familiarise ourselves with JWST again. What do we need to know about this telescope?
Okay, so this is a telescope that's in space to start with, as the name suggests. And it's a partnership between NASA, the European Space Agency, and the Canadian Space Agency. And it's something that astronomers have been waiting for decades. As people who've been planning studies for it, since the late 90s when it was first commissioned. And it's really been seen as the successor to the Hubble Space Telescope, and which brought us all these spectacular images of the universe. And if you've seen a picture of the Horsehead Nebula or, you know, any of those iconic images, it'll probably have been taken by Hubble. And the James Webb, it is taking things up a level. It's much bigger than Hubble, and it's also about 1.5 million kilometres away from the Earth, and it's in orbit around the Sun. And what that allows you to do is it takes it out of the sort of interference of the Earth's atmosphere. It's shaded from the Sun by the Earth. So it's got this side that's incredibly cold, and that allows it to pick up the faintest, most distant light from the very earliest stages of the universe. And it also allows it to capture details of distant planets in other solar systems that we've never even been able to dream of being able to capture before. So there's been sort of all this anticipation. And I think it's fair to say that it really has delivered. I mean, even the people who've been planning these studies have been pretty blown away with the type of images and the data that they've been getting back.
There have been so many stories from JWST's observations so far, and so I want to get into what it's been looking at. So let's start with the earliest, which also makes them the furthest away, these galaxies from the early universe. How far back, aka how far, has JWST managed to go?
It's been able to pick up light from galaxies around 350 million years after the Big Bang, 13.7 billion years ago. So this is sort of the dawn of the universe, basically, when the very first galaxies were forming. And it's allowing astronomers to really test what they've put together in computer models. And now they're able to really look, you know, the real thing and see whether it matches up. And, you know, there are some hints that maybe there are slight differences between what they'd expected to see and what's actually out there, which is, you know, it could really get into some of the biggest cosmological questions of, you know, how dark matter and dark energy were behaving at that point in time and how the first galaxies were formed as well, because that's still a bit of an open question.
And these galaxies, some of the first in our universe, we think, are very intriguing as well, aren't they? I know they've been called universe breakers because their existence could potentially upend some of our current theories of cosmology. So what do we know about them?
Cosmologists tend to think of galaxy formation as almost being, it's almost like a sort of snowball effect. So you start with some little pockets of, you know, areas that randomly end up a bit more dense than others in the very early universe. And we're just talking about dust and gas and stuff swirling around here. And then because those are little sort of gravitational dips almost, more stuff falls into those areas and then they snowball into a galaxy. But, you know, you'd imagine that if you followed that train of thought, the earliest galaxies would be really small. And then it would only be when more of them had pulled together that you'd get bigger galaxies. But what was really surprising in the James Webb observations is that they found galaxies around the size of the Milky Way, which is completely different from what you'd expect, or at least you'd only expect very few galaxies of that size at that point in time. And I think there's still a bit of an open question over whether these observations are really sort of going to upend our current theories. But there does feel like there's been a sort of building up of observations from that very early period that are a little bit mismatched with what the theories suggest. So there is this sort of excitement in the air that they could really be onto something and there could be a sort of big shift in thinking.
So zooming forward to today, or closer to the present time, one of the other purposes of the telescope is to study exoplanets, so planets that are outside our own solar system. And 2 months ago, the telescope discovered the catchily named K2-18b. Why did this particular one excite some scientists?
So one of the really exciting things that James Webb is able to do is not just look at the exoplanet and spot that it's there and measure its size, but also it can detect what chemicals are present in the atmosphere of these exoplanets. And that could indirectly give you clues to whether that planet might be habitable, whether it might have the sort of conditions that would favour life as we know it on Earth, at least. And so there have been various different planets out there that have been targeted. And one of the most exciting ones to come back so far was this planet K2-18b, which had signs of a possible liquid ocean on the planet. So they're not getting pictures of these planets. They're taking the spectra of the atmosphere and they're basically measuring the starlight as it's just being filtered through the atmosphere of the exoplanet. And depending on what gases are in the atmosphere, different bits of the starlight get absorbed. So they're looking for basically missing bits of the starlight, and then that's kind of telling them, okay, there's a bit of hydrogen there that's absorbed that bit of the spectrum. So on this planet, they discovered a balance of gases. So they found methane and carbon dioxide, and sort of plugging those measurements into their models, it hinted that the conditions where you'd get that particular balance, it is likely to be when you've got an ocean, or at least there's some kind of hints that there could be an ocean.
So chemical signatures that indicate water are a hint that there could be life on a planet. But what else would we be looking for?
Often what astronomers or astrobiologists are looking for are signs that they've got what they call the big six elements that are related to life. And they're the things that we know are essential for life on Earth. So it's carbon, oxygen, hydrogen, nitrogen, phosphorus and sulfur. So that's one thing that they're looking for. And then they're also looking for sort of balances of gases where there's something a bit off that you wouldn't get just through geological processes like volcanoes or cloud systems, which could hint that there's some sort of biological process going on. There's something producing carbon dioxide or a different chemical process than what you would get just with rocks and sunlight and geology.
Well, on that point, JWST turned up yet another mystery, something called Jupiter Mass Binary Objects, or JUMBOs, a name I can definitely get behind. And despite being planet-sized, we don't actually know what they are, because in other ways, they seem more like stars. So right now, they're defying classification. Tell me more about that.
Yeah, so this is a slightly different kind of observation. And this is from a team at ESA, who they were inspired to look for these objects based on some observations they'd done with ground-based telescopes about a decade or so ago, where they were looking in nebula. So these are the sort of big clouds where stars are formed. And they found these very small objects that almost seem to break the limit for how small you can get a star to be. And so they decided to basically point James Webb in the same direction and ask that question, how small do these things go down? And so it was a really big surprise when they looked, they found these objects that are about the size of Jupiter. And in particular, they found pairs of these objects rotating about each other. And so this was really intriguing because, first of all, you shouldn't be getting kind of Jupiter-sized star-type things. Like stars shouldn't be able to form that small. But the fact that you were getting pairs of them seems to rule out the idea that they're just a planet that's been like kicked out of orbit from its star and just found itself in this cloud, floating freely and not connected to anything, because it feels unlikely, or at least this is what the astronomers said, and it kind of makes intuitive sense that you would get two of these things kicked out and then end up neatly orbiting each other.
That sounds very exciting. And on the theme of strange worlds, and particularly worlds that frankly don't sound very habitable, last week you reported that the telescope had also revealed a planet where it rains sand. So talk me through that discovery and why it's been called the Candy Floss Planet.
Yeah, so it's called the Candy Floss Planet because it's basically, I mean, I find it hard to imagine a fluffy planet, but one of the astronomers said to me, this is one of the fluffiest planets out there. And it basically meant that it's very big. It's about the size of Jupiter, but weighs far less than Jupiter. So it's got much smaller mass. So it's got this really diffuse atmosphere. And that's made it a good target for James Webb because there's a lot more scope for getting measurements from that. So they detected that there was water vapor in its atmosphere. There was sulfur dioxide, which would give it a smell of burnt matches, basically that smell you get when you light a match. And also silicate, which is basically what sand is made of. And through the measurements that they made, they could see that there were sort of peaks and troughs of this silicate signature coming and going, which they've deduced was because there were clouds in the atmosphere. And not water vapor clouds, but clouds made of sand. And that on this planet, you'd have something like the water cycle on Earth, but with silicate sand instead. So you'd have these clouds of solid little sand particles that would be high up in the atmosphere, and then they'd get dense enough that they'd start falling down and turn into sand vapor, essentially, sand gas. So, yeah, I mean, it's just mad really to think about. Apparently they had envisaged that this was a possibility beforehand. But I think, you know, for the average person, the idea that you have planets with sand clouds and, you know, there were other ones out there with where it could rain metal. So, yeah, I think it's just a case of opening your imagination to the kind of whole range of weird exotic planets that could be out there.
Hannah, James Webb is obviously astounding all of us. You know, it's amazing, even the scientists who are going through all this data that's coming back. But we're also getting just absolutely stunning images of our universe. And when I look at them, I find they give me a real sense of awe and amazement, you know, actually in a time where that can feel hard to come by. And to me, that also seems like a really important part of this telescope.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I think that it's something that the scientists and any member of the public can share, this sense of wonder at, you know, how big the universe is, how amazing it is, all the mysteries that are out there. The sense that it gives to you of you being this tiny speck in such a vast, wondrous universe. Yeah, shared sense of inspiration and awe, really. As you said, it's not every piece of news can give you that.
Well, Hannah, it's been so fascinating, and I'm definitely going to open up my imagination to all the different incredible exoplanets that could be out there and these strange objects that we don't really know anything about. So thank you so much for coming on.
Oh, a pleasure.
Thanks again to Hannah Devlin. You can keep up to date with her reporting on theguardian.com. And that's it for today. The producer was Josh Anchana. The sound design was by Tony Onochuku. And the executive producer is Ellie Bury. We'll be back on Tuesday. See you then.
This is The Guardian.
Looking for your next great podcast? We live in unprecedented times. To make sense of it, what if you could learn from some of the most influential people on the planet? The podcast Tools and Weapons is hosted by Microsoft's Vice Chair and President Brad Smith. Every week, he has a candid conversation with guests, including prime ministers and Pulitzer Prize-winning journalists. The latest episode features Bayer CEO Bill Anderson. Though most of us know Bayer for pharmaceuticals, they're also focused on crop science. They're putting digital tools in the hands of farmers to get the most out of every acre. Listen to Tools and Weapons with Brad Smith, wherever you get your podcasts.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.